Here we go. Welcome into another episode of the Patriots Podcast. I'm Sean. I'm without my normal co-host, James. He is on the road again. He just can't wait to get off the road again. That's right. James is occupied elsewhere, and I'm sure he wishes he was here with us discussing the wild card weekend, the craziness that happened, and then the upcoming divisional round. But hey, what are you going to do? The NFL is going absolutely bonkers right now. So much stuff going on. I guess we can start with the games last weekend. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable place to start. I don't have much to say about this Texans-Colts game other than that the Colts are red hot and absolutely steamrolled the Texans. Everybody knows that various teams have Achilles heels. And for the Patriots, their Achilles heel seems to be protecting Tom Brady. And the Texans kind of have the same exact one. And they had no chance of running the ball at all. Absolutely zero chance. And then Deshaun Watson was running around like crazy, and no one was getting open. So it's kind of similar to what you could see happen to the Patriots at some point in this playoff. But all the credit in the world to the Colts. That team is wildly outperforming their talent level, at least in terms of what we know now. We might find out looking back that this team is just stacked with Pro Bowlers. But for right now, you're like, who are these people? Who are these guys that are just tearing up the AFC South on the way to what? Like 10 out of 11 games that they won. And the only team that beat them was the Jaguars. But I got to say, I'm super happy that they were the sixth seed. And so they automatically go to Kansas City because I wouldn't want to see them coming into New England right now, even though the Pats wiped them, especially in the third quarter of that game on the Thursday night game in October earlier this season. Chiefs are going to have their hands full. I do not envy them. And then the next game, the night game. Oh, boy, this was my lock of the week. Last week, the Seahawks, everybody goes, oh, well, the most overused phrase this time of year is that's not a team you want to see in January. Yeah, duh, because they're all good teams. They're all playoff teams. But the thing is, everyone was getting on the Seahawks bandwagon. They're like, oh, my God, they beat the Chiefs. They beat that. And it's just like, yeah, you don't want to see the Seahawks in Seattle. You want to see them anywhere else. That's a 500 team almost every season when they're away from Seattle. And that includes going to San Francisco and Arizona every year. So I was, needless to say, thought they were pretty much overhyped, the Seahawks were. For a conundrum that offense is, oh, we're run first. And it's like they read their own press clippings going, oh, you're the number one running team in the league. And then they go into Dallas and they can't run for shit. And guess what they keep doing? Hand the ball off. Hey, idiots, you got a Pro Bowl quarterback there, Super Bowl champion. Why don't you freaking use him? And every time they did, good things happened. And then they would go right back to just pounding Chris Carson right up the middle. Didn't make no sense whatsoever. That being said, wasn't super confident about the Cowboys going into this. Ezekiel Elliott is like a superhero on the field. He's right neck and neck with Todd Gurley in my book, if not ahead of him. He probably is ahead of him. He's more durable. But Dak Prescott took it up another level with his legs in this one. And that seemed to be the difference, kind of. I just remembered Sebastian Janikowski trying to kick that 62-yarder. And a friend of mine had Janikowski to score over 7.5 points in that game. And to that point, he had scored 6. And this is in the first half. And we're like, oh, geez, he makes this kick. It's over. You got your bet. And Janikowski walks out there. I love it. They show him on the sideline. The coach keeps coming up to him like, dude, do you think you can make a 62-yarder? And he's like, yeah, no problem. Not stretching, nothing, not warming up. You know, before kicks, you always see kickers launching them into the net. No, not Janikowski. He looks like he's ready for a cigarette. And he just waddles his way out there. Love the way he lines up for kicks. Doesn't go back into the side. Just goes straight diagonal. Yeah, that'll be good enough. Walks out there. Kicked the living shit out of that ball, but goes wide right, and he instantly wrecked his hamstring. I don't know what happened there, but that dude's like 43 and hasn't been taking care of his body. You know, he's not a TB12 method type of guy. That he goes down the first half. Second half, all of a sudden the Seahawks are a go-for-it-on-fourth-down team because they're going for two-point conversions. They can't even hit an extra point, which, I don't know, it kind of makes sense. I mean, what are the odds you make a two-point conversion? 60%, something like that? What are the odds that your punter is going to kick a 33-yard field goal? I don't know. Might be pretty close to that. It might be worth the gamble to get the extra point. Turns out it was, because I think they got both of them. But you saw late game heroics again from Russell Wilson, getting them all the way down there, getting that touchdown. But the punter looked like he never tried an onside kick in his life. And it really came down to Dak Prescott converting, what was that, like a 3rd-and-14 on a designed QB draw. He dives for the end zone. He's marked short after the review. But an incredible effort. I can't believe the lapse defensively to make that happen. I called the play before it happened. It was so clear what they were doing. You knew they didn't want to give up any big plays. They were like kind of close to the edge of field goal range. If he gets sacked, all of a sudden that field goal is in the 50-yard range. That's no layup. So I think the Seahawks coaching staff bungled the crap out of that game, but the Janikowski career-ending hamstring strain that really did them in that one. Now, from here, I could go chronologically, but I won't because I want to finish with the Patriots' opponent for next weekend. So I'll skip ahead to the Eagles and Bears game. This is another game that I've been saying on this podcast all year that Mitchell Trubisky is a liability at best. And he threw how many balls right between the numbers of Eagles players? They dropped them, but he threw them. And if those are converted, like any Bears fan who's sitting here like, oh, we got robbed. It's like, yeah, it came down to be pretty close. But the other team gave up some stuff, too. Like on that, what was it, the drive right before halftime when Anthony Miller, my boy from Memphis, goes up, catches that ball, takes 4 steps, gets stripped. And they call it incomplete, and then nobody picks up the ball. There's 3 points right there that the Eagles would have had. You don't know where they bring that ball if he picks it up and starts returning it. I guess they wouldn't give you the return to the blown dead. But still, that was a sloppy game on both sides. It was a defensive game, which I love. I like that. A lot of people were saying how the Bears' defense didn't play up to snuff. I thought they did. I thought they played pretty well. In fact, the interception that Nick Foles threw in the back of the end zone that looked like a really bad decision. That ball was, I think his arm was hit on that ball. He might have been trying to throw it out of the back of the end zone. He might have been just trying to throw an absolute jump ball. Instead, it lands in the middle of the end zone and they pick it off. That's a big play for them. I think they might have turned that into points. But regardless, it goes down to the end. And the Eagles have some magic. They have some magic. I was on the phone with somebody with 5 minutes to go, and they're like, oh, I guess the Eagles aren't going to win. I'm like, nah, I still think they are. They got the ball. They got the ball, and if they score a touchdown, they got the lead. And it took all the way down to 4th-and-goal. I love that their 4th-and-goal play was so dumb. Oh, God, I hate when people run sprint right option. And I know it's one of the most famous plays in NFL history because of Dwight Clark and this and that. But you limit your options so much. If all you're going to do is you're going to run in out from the slot and you're going to roll your quarterback towards him, that brings the entire defense with the quarterback. That limits everything. If that receiver doesn't get open immediately, you're screwed. That's your whole game. I mean, don't you remember how the Eagles got in this place into this position in the first hand? They in the divisional round last year, I think it was divisional round, they were the wild card. Jesus, it was the wild. No, it was divisional round. Jesus, don't listen to me. Actually, you are, so whatever. The divisional round when they were playing the Falcons, and the Falcons come down to a 4th-and-goal from the 1-yard line, and guess what freaking play they ran? Sprint right option. And what happened? The slot receiver didn't get open, and then Julio Jones slipped, and then Matt Ryan's pulling it down, trying to Joe Montana it, and he throws one to Julio Jones, who almost made the catch, but still didn't work out. And then the Eagles turn around and run the same play and get away with it. Hilarious. But I know I trashed Trubisky earlier. He drove his team all the way down there. I mean, it was benefited by a Tyreek Cohen really big kick return, which is something you just can't give up if you're the Eagle. You just cannot give that up. But Trubisky came back and he threw a dime to Allen Robinson down the right sideline. And then he just kind of marched them into range. And normally I get on here and I shit on teams that settle for long field goals. Didn't feel like they were settling for a long field goal in that drive. It felt like they were trying to push it ahead, and things just weren't there. So they settle. They end up attempting a 43-yard field goal. Everyone knows what happened. The double post I don't know. It came out the next day that ball was tipped, that it was blocked, and that I don't know if that's what caused it to go out. You never know if he would have made that field goal if it wasn't tipped. But there's part of me that's like, are you sure that it's his fault? I mean, if that ball got batted directly into his face, would we be sitting here going, oh, the kicker sucks? Or would we be saying, hey, that guard got blown up? I think it would be the latter. But because it was slightly tipped and nobody really noticed at the time, it's like, oh, it's all the kicker's fault. Now, he probably could have kicked it higher. It was a 43-yarder. It wasn't a 60-yarder. And he kind of kicked a line drive. Granted, there was some crazy win that game. I don't know. It was a tough situation. That was not a gimme by any stretch. And unfortunately, everyone saw what it looked like to make one, so you thought it was easy because of the timeout there. So I guess that brings me to the Chargers and Ravens game. The Chargers came in and played a good game. They played a very, very good defensive game. Melvin Ingram, God damn it, Melvin Ingram's incredible. I've relayed this story multiple times, but when I was watching Melvin Ingram when he was at South Carolina, I watched him get a sack on one play and an interception 25 yards downfield the very next play. He's unique. There aren't people like that. He's such an instinctive player. He's so smart, super athletic, and he took over that game on Sunday. He was nearly unblockable. He could do whatever he wanted, and just even in the run game. People underrate edge players in the run game, especially against an offense that features the fastest quarterback in recent memory. No offense, Michael Vick. I mean, recent. And he was able to make big plays in that game. Joey Bosa set the edge as well. And the Chargers with a really unique game plan where they throw out seven defensive backs on almost every single play. I mean, who's heard of that? That's craziness. And it worked. And it worked great. But the fourth quarter rolled around and everybody's screaming for Average Joe to come in off the bench. And I'm looking at John Harbaugh and I'm just thinking, your best chance of winning this game is probably putting Joe Flacco in. But you're probably still not going to win. And then you've wrecked the confidence of this young kid, the youngest quarterback to ever start a playoff game, 21 years old. Granted, he turned 22 the very next day. But that's your future, is that dude wearing number 8. And you're going to take him out of the game in the playoffs and be like, dude, you're losing us the game. I think we got a better guy on the bench. And then what happens? Next year, you just give him the job back and go, oh, well, sorry about that. It's like that guy's confidence is wrecked. And so he resisted the urge to do that. And props to him because Lamar started to turn it around. And I don't think Joe Flacco could have done any better than Lamar did at the end of that game in the fourth quarter. I think a big part of that decision, just watching the game and the way the Chargers were pressuring him, I mean, Joe Flacco falls apart under pressure. He's not moving. He's not creating any space. So the way that Lamar was able to get out of there and make plays downfield, I mean, that play, he's running full speed to his right, throws back across his body to the left and gets it over Derwin James's head with his outstretched hands by like 4 inches. That was unbelievable. What a play. Joe Flacco ain't making that play. Joe Flacco was sacked a while ago, and that's 40 seconds and 10 yards. And Lamar Jackson was avoiding those plays, and it came all the way down to the end. And yes, he got strip sacked, and yes, he has problems with ball protection. He's 21. He's got time to work on it. But I don't think they even get those two touchdowns if you got Flacco in the game. They probably get one. They almost definitely get one, I think. But I don't think they get two and the ball back. But you got to give credit to the Chargers. They won that game, and they won it with great defense and mistake-free offense. That offense is kind of funny for me. Melvin Gordon's clearly banged up. He's got like braces on both legs. He's a really good running back when he's healthy, but he's not healthy right now. Luckily for them, they got a good backup. That Aaron kid, Eckhart, I can't remember his name. No, that's an actor. No, the backup running back they got is pretty good, but he's no Melvin Gordon. That offensive line is good, not great. And Philip Rivers, if we're talking about statues in the pocket, there's nobody like Phil Rivers. Doesn't he remind you of Drew Bledsoe? I mean, he throws from just above his shoulder. He's got a pretty good arm. Bledsoe had a cannon, but Rivers and Bledsoe were just so immobile. Bledsoe was obviously, oddly enough, like fast straight line speed, but trying to get him to move side to side, not happening, not even a little bit. But Philip is having probably his best year this decade, gotta be, since the Chargers were super good previously in like the late 2000s period. And then that defense, man, that defense is good. Oh, I skipped over the receivers. The receivers are like three or four deep. Plus, they got multiple tight ends. Antonio Gates is ageless. He is a route-running dream. I don't know how he hesitates so well, and he's got these tiny little subtle movements, and he uses that big bulbous body to box people out and then just creates enough space. And if you look on third downs, that's where Phil's going. He's throwing to him. When they're trying to run the clock at the end of the game, it's like third and 15, and they throw the ball. Like, why in the world are you throwing it there? You're not going to convert third and 15. You're going to throw an incomplete pass. And if you're going to do a check down, it's still got the option of being incomplete, and you'll probably get the same amount of yards you would if you did just a draw up the middle. But they were right, I was wrong. And they complete to Antonio Gates for 10 yards right up the middle. Clock keeps going. Oddly enough, a very safe play. And then you see on the sideline, Antonio Gates is just ripping into Phil Rivers. I don't know why, but he was tearing into him. That's something to monitor. Oh, shoot. I just remembered, too. On that last possession the Chargers had, Melvin Gordon goes out to the left. I think they did like a little slightly trick play. Gets him out on the left edge. He runs for the first down, sits down. Should be game. Called back on a holding call. Absolute phantom holding call. It was a borderline, but you don't throw that flag in that situation. And Chargers got totally screwed on that, and it really almost bit them in the butt if it weren't for 42 on their team. I can't remember his name, but comes up with that strip sack. They recover, and it's over. Chargers are a heck of a team, man. And people look at Anthony Lynn, they're like, who is this coach? Like, I don't know anything about him. Why would I be afraid of that coaching staff? Or just that head coach. And the reason is you look at the coordinators. They're both former head coaches. Ken Wisenhunt run the offense. Say what you want about him as a head coach, but he's been a successful Super Bowl winning coordinator. On the defensive side, Gus Bradley, same thing. Poor head coach in Jacksonville. Those were bad teams, though. Those were real bad teams. And but you go back to him in Seattle. I mean, he's the one that founded the Legion of Boom. He's the one that created that cover three defense. And that kind of brings me to where I'm at with this Patriots game. It's like, Brady, if Brady knows what you're doing, you're screwed. That's pretty much where it's at. I mean, unless he knows what you're doing, but you don't give him time to exploit it, that's the only other option in terms of stopping him. But the Chargers present a serious challenge because they have Derwin James, an all-pro strong safety, 6'2", 215. He is molded to stop Gronkowski. Not that Gronk has been that great so far. They have another first-team all-pro defensive back, Desmond King, who is a smaller corner. He actually might match up very nicely with Julian Edelman. And then they have two outstanding edge rushers. Joey Bosa is a force of nature. And as I mentioned earlier when I fanboyed about Melvin Ingram, that boy can get stuff done. He can make it happen in all kinds of ways. They don't really need a traditional inside linebacker because of the way that their safeties are able to play. They play a lot of three safety. It's very reminiscent of what we see here in New England. The problem is that they are primarily a cover three team. That's what they do. That's their bread and butter. And if they come out in the cover three in the same way that Seattle did in that Super Bowl, and we've seen the Jaguars do in last year's AFC Championship game, you can have some success against Brady, but he's going to figure you out in the second half, and he's going to make plays, and you're going to see a 25-plus number right next to the NE on the scoreboard. And are the Chargers going to be able to put up 25 against us? Actually, I think probably. That's the problem. We got our cornerbacks are fairly deep. See, this is the issue. A lot of people think the Chargers are going to be able to run against us. I don't see it happening. Melvin Gordon is beat up, and actually, I don't know. No, I don't see it happening. No, because I was wondering if Belichick would try to give them the run so they don't pass it. I don't think that's the case. I think he's going to stop the run because we want maximum possessions on offense, because against this cover three scheme, we're going to need to put together 5-minute drives. This isn't going to be lightning quick scores against this Chargers team. That doesn't happen against this defense. So it's going to be 5-7 minute drives. So we need maximum possessions offensively. And so I don't think he's going to just give them the run and then watch the clock run down. I think he's going to want to get more possessions offense. How many times can I say that? Pretty sure we'll see Keenan Allen matched up against Stephon Gilmore. I give the edge to Gilmore on that, although he's not the exact type of receiver that he typically does his best against. I think he'll do just fine. He's played great this year. On the other side, Mike Williams scares the crap out of me. I don't think we have anybody that can rise with him. He's above the rim type player. I hate that phrase. Can't believe I just used it. But our safeties aren't getting up there. Devin McCourty's not getting up there. Jerron Harmon's not getting up there. And none of the other cornerbacks are either. Actually, J.C. Jackson's probably our best option because he's a thicker, bigger, more physical guy. But he's going to need some help because Mike Williams will go deep. He's not a traditional tall receiver who's just going to body you at the line of scrimmage like Brandon Marshall. He'll go downtown. Phil Rivers, you just got to get him off the spot. That's hard to do because he's got such a quick release. The offensive line they have there is like I said, good. It's not great. The Patriots have definitely a better offensive line than Chargers. Definitely. Problem is Chargers have a better defensive line than the Patriots do. So it's kind of a wash there. I just think with the power running game that the Patriots have, very similar to the Ravens, we might see a similar alignment that they played last week, the Chargers will. And I think having that on film, it's like I said, it 58 out of 59 plays, they played with seven defensive backs. The most any other team has done that personnel package this year in a single game, 18 plays. This was a unique game plan. And if they try to employ that again against Brady, how many times do you think he's watched each of those 58 plays? I bet he's watched each one of them 10 times. So he's not going to be fooled out there. He's going to have all kinds of ideas, he and Josh McDaniels both, on how to attack that type of personnel package, everything that they're doing with it, what to spot, what tendencies you see. And I just don't see it being nearly as effective the second go around as the first time that you see it on film, particularly against an experienced coaching staff. Like, it also helps that the I don't know how this keeps happening to the Chargers, but it's a 1 p.m. game. East Coast is the earliest game of the weekend for the second weekend in a row, and the West Coast LA Chargers get stuck with it again. I don't know how it keeps happening to them, but Russell Okung thinks that there's a conspiracy out there, and I'm starting to believe him. I mean, they called that holding call on him, and he clearly didn't do it. I mean, maybe he did. So really, for me, it comes down to, look, this is a playoff game in Gillette Stadium. Rarely do the Patriots lose one of these. It's only happened once in the divisional round, and that was to the New York Jets in 2010. I'm talking about in the Brady Belichick era. Brady's better than Phil Rivers, although Phil Rivers has played at least as good as Brady this year, probably better. Belichick and his staff is better than the Chargers staff. They are. This is a home game. We have a better offensive line, and that might be where the Patriots' advantages end. That might be it. Maybe special teams. We probably have better special teams. So I don't see it being a blowout. I think that the Chargers, everyone's going to say, oh, it's going to be 31 degrees. They're a California team. Look, they just won in windy Baltimore in 40-degree weather with a physical football team. They just beat them up. I don't see that being that big an issue. If it snows, oh, God damn it, I want it to snow. That would be incredible. But you can't just hope for that and neglect everything else. I think it'll be a close football game. I think these teams are very evenly matched. When they played last fall, it was a very tight game. And Belichick came out afterwards, and he seemed like he was going, phew. Like, it seemed like he didn't really expect to win that game. And, you know, it was pretty close, although the Patriots got out to a lead early. Going back to the game in 2014 in San Diego, back when they were the San Diego Chargers, that was also a pretty close game. I think it might have been a 10-point game. Edelman had a real big, long touchdown, and that was the difference in the game. And you take that play away, and all of a sudden, tight as anything. So I think both teams will score in the 20s. I just got the Patriots at 27 and the Chargers at 24. Maybe 27-23. That's where I got it. Because I don't think we'll leave it within a field goal. I see it playing out that the Pats will spread the lead at the end of the game, and then the Chargers will have like a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go. Phil Rivers driving down the field needing a touchdown, and he's not going to get there. That's what I see. What can I say? That's what I see. The other games this weekend, unbelievable. I mean, the Colts Chiefs, the best team during the season. Well, you could say the Saints, but the best team in the conference during the season against the hottest team in the NFL right now. And yes, I say the Colts are hotter than the Eagles. Definitely. That's a great game. It's outdoors. There's a dome team coming in who's already overachieved. I lean towards the Chiefs in this game, although Andy Reid doesn't have the best playoff record. And the Chiefs really fit the mold of a typical team that's great in the regular season, not good in the playoffs. They are a high-powered offense with a complete sieve for a defense, and they're going up against a very balanced, well-led, good team with a good quarterback and a great offensive line. This is the formula to beat the Chiefs. I'm just really hesitant because of the elements, really. That's the only reason. If this game was at a neutral site, I take the Colts. But since it's in Arrowhead and it's going to be nasty out middle of January in Kansas City, I lean towards the Chiefs, and I might eat those words next week. We'll see. I know there's usually at least one. Actually, no, there isn't usually an upset in the divisional round. These teams that come off a bye, they're playing a home game. They're the best two teams in each conference. They tend to win. At least in the last 5 years, they win almost every single time. But I think this year is slightly different. I think there's going to be at least one upset. And I am the team that is most available for an upset, in my opinion, is the Rams, although they do have the best defensive player in the NFL. The problem is, I think they would lose if they faced any of the other three road opponents. They get the luck of the draw to face the Cowboys in a matchup that's going to feature the two best running backs in the NFL. I'm excited for this game, too. What the Cowboys have done defensively to the Saints previously during the season and then to the Seahawks just last week was impressive, although the Seahawks kind of blew it. The Rams had a real tough stretch. When they went to Chicago, they had a couple other bad games. I think they've probably ironed some of it out. I think Jared Goff got some playoff experience last year, though he didn't win. But, you know, it should be an upset. I think it should be an upset. You know what? I'm changing my Chiefs pick. I'm taking the Colts in that game because I don't know why, but I got to hit my quota of one upset this weekend. I just don't see the Cowboys doing it. I could see any of the Chargers would beat the Rams, definitely. I think they would definitely beat them. Colts would, the Eagles would, but I think the Rams are able to hold off the Cowboys because I just don't have that much belief in the boys. Sorry, Dak. I love you. But I don't have that much belief in you just yet. Now, the Saints taking on the Eagles. The Saints absolutely demolished the Eagles like a month and a half ago. Different teams back then. Carson Wentz was still playing. And the Saints were on. They peaked. They had peaked at that point. The Eagles, I just don't see them going into New Orleans, going into the dome there, taking care of business against that offensive line. That's the whole engine for this Eagles team is Nick Foles making crazy third down plays and the defensive line of the Eagles dominating everybody. And this Saints offensive line is as good as it gets in the NFL. And I don't think they're going to be able to do it. They got massive home field advantage. They got plenty of tape. They've been rested. They're all healthy. Alvin Kamara hasn't played in like 3 weeks. Neither is Drew Brees. They are just going to be ready to rock and roll. And I think that they're going to take it. Now, the last thing I wanted to talk about are some of these head coaching hires. It's been a whirlwind. I mean, where are all these people coming from? You're hiring like a college assistant coach for the Cardinals. Cliff Kingsbury goes from assistant coach. Oh, wait, he was the head coach at Texas Tech, but he was going to be the offensive coordinator at USC. Immediately reneges on that contract and becomes the head coach of the Cardinals, a guy that was drafted 3 years after Brady to be his backup and failed at that job. Not that I'm saying he's going to fail in Arizona. You got Bruce Arians coming out of the booth to take over the Buccaneers. I mean, Bruce Arians is what, like 65? And he's your future? I don't get that. I love that he brings back Todd Bowles, though. Todd Bowles was a hard one for me. I got a soft spot for him. He takes over that piss-poor defense they have in Tampa. I mean, good luck, dude. You got your work cut out for you. Bruce Arians says that Jameis Winston is the building block and everything's going to be built around him. It's like, dude, they were so close to getting rid of him. What the heck happened? I thought they probably should have too. And now they're just doubling down and they're just going to give him a big contract and try to, I don't know, bring in another DeSean Jackson clone. Who knows what they're going to do? But I like Bruce Arians. I'm glad he's back in the league. Offensive coordinator they got there is Byron Leftwich. The guy's been an offensive coordinator for like six games. And Arians is all excited to have him there. He's been a quarterback's coach for 1 year. 2 years. 2 years as a quarterback's coach. Half a season as offensive coordinator. And he's all pumped to have him run his offense and try to resurrect Jameis Winston's career. Tough task down there in Tampa Bay. Cleveland decides to stay home with Freddie Kitchens. I kind of like that pick. Good for them. Good job. Happy for Freddie. The Packers go with, I mean, why would you do it? Matt LaFleur from Tennessee. For some reason, he's one of those highly touted offensive assistants. Why? Have you seen any progress out of Marcus Mariota? Why did it take them so long to develop Derrick Henry? Why did it take till December until Derrick Henry could be a good running back? Like, I like Corey Davis has progressed, but he's not a number one receiver. He's not a great receiver yet. He should be. They got the best tackled tandem in the NFL, and this offense can't run the ball that well. It's just and then you're going to hand over the keys to Aaron Rodgers to this guy. I don't know why he's got such name recognition, but he does. Cincinnati's leaning towards Zach Taylor. Former U.S. president, served 2 years, followed by his vice president, Millard Fillmore. No. Zach Taylor, not Zachary Taylor. Zach Taylor was a quarterback's coach for the Rams, or currently is, as they're still in the playoffs. But the Bengals seem to want him to be their head coach. I guess he spent some time at the University of Cincinnati. He's only 35 years old, and they want to give him the keys to the kingdom. And good for you, dude. You're going to get another 16-year tenure like Marvin Lewis, and all you got to do is not be the worst. That's it. Just don't be the worst all the time. Okay? Good luck over there. The biggest head-scratcher for me is Adam Gase. Adam Gase was another hot offensive coordinator, hot name on the market. Dolphins snatch him up. They go, look, we got this young quarterback. We think he's a doofus. And could you please make him into a decent NFL player? And he goes, sure. Look what I did with Peyton Manning. I might have made Jay Cutler better than he ever has been outside of the Josh McDaniels season. And yeah, give me the keys to Tannehill and let's see what happens. And 4 years later, bupkis, worse than ever. 4 years, 3 years, whatever. And then the Jets, after having faced him twice every year and seen the befuddled look on his face, decide, hey, you know what? That's the guy I want on my team. Let's get him to lead this dump show that we got going here with Sam Darnold. What could make his career get off to a more delayed start? Oh, how about this coach that can't seem to coach quarterbacks anymore? That seems to help. I mean, at least go outside the division. It's not like he's some superhero. The guy failed. And you don't even give him a chance to sit back and think about, what could I have done better? Give him a chance to reprove himself. You know, like some other head coaches who needed a stint in between their first and second jobs, like Bill Belichick. When he goes and he reproves himself and re-establishes what he wants to do. Adam Gase just walks from one job to the next like he's Eric Mangini. Like he's, what's his face? The dude, Herm Edwards. Herm Edwards just walked from one job to the next. Was he good at either? No. Is Adam Gase going to be good at this? No. Do the Jets have any chance of getting a good coach? No. Now, my favorite head coaching hire, Broncos. Broncos came up with a complete unknown 2 years ago when they plucked Vance Joseph out of obscurity and a bottom 10 defense that he was in charge of in Miami. And they make him the head coach of one of the biggest fan bases in the NFL. And this time, John Elway goes out and he says, you know what? I'm going to get somebody who's established, who's proven, who the players will buy into. And he gets Vic Fangio days after the Bears get removed from the playoffs. Vic Fangio is an older guy. He's a loud dude. He doesn't have a filter. And I'm looking forward to his press conferences in a big way. But Vic Fangio is going to come in and breathe life into that defense that hasn't been there since Wade Phillips left. And then to add to that, Gary Kubiak, who has been a special assistant, something like that. I don't know what his title has been. He's been in the front office, essentially, and he wanted to coach again. And they denied all interviews for somebody to coach him, to try to interview him to see if he would be their coach. And they promote Gary Kubiak to, I don't know if assistant head coach or offense coordinator, whatever it is, but he's going to run the offense. And so you kind of get an offensive head coach and a defensive head coach, and you can protect Gary Kubiak from all the stresses that come from head coaching, because you know he's had health issues, and you hope that doesn't crop up again. But and you give Vic Fangio the opportunity, his first opportunity to be an NFL head coach, although he's been a great coach for a long time. I think it's an outstanding move. The only problem is they don't have a quarterback. That's an issue. I think there's a distinct possibility that Joe Flacco becomes the next quarterback of the Denver Broncos. I think you also need to make a long-term solution at that position because, look, the ceiling on Flacco is still pretty low. But the best Flacco ever played was with Gary Kubiak. That was the best he ever played. And we've seen that offense a whole bunch of times just in Denver. I mean, look back at Jake Plummer. Jake Plummer was successful with Gary Kubiak's offense there. So I think that might be a good bridge for them to then get to a younger quarterback. And it would make them relevant in the interim. It would make them almost immediately relevant. And you don't know what else they could possibly do at the quarterback position. But they still got Emmanuel Sanders. That defense is still good. Von Miller's there. Bradley Chubb had as many sacks as a rookie as Javon Kearse. And I don't know how long you all have been watching football, but Javon Kearse was like a meteorite hitting the NFL when he was a rookie in 1999. He was immediately called the freak. He took his team to a Super Bowl. He lost, but and Bradley Chubb has very quietly accumulated more sacks than Javon Kearse did. 14, I think. 13 or 14. And he'll probably finish third in defensive rookie of the year voting behind Darius Leonard and Derwin James. So I really like that hire. The only one that is left unhired, or the positions left unfilled, Miami, of course. Miami Dolphins coach. Yeah, why would you do it? Yeah, let's go to the beach. Yeah, we'll figure it out later. Are they just going to pounce on whatever teams get eliminated in the divisional round? They're just going to be like, who's their best assistant coach? All right, let's go with them. Not do any homework. Just sipping Mai Tais. I have zero respect for the Miami establishment there. Oh boy, this is going to get me in trouble. But I think that one might be the hardest job. It's like the ownership includes all kinds, like Gloria Stefan and I don't know who, all the other celebrities that are part of the ownership group. You got players that want to go to South Beach because they want to live the lifestyle of South Beach. They don't want to live in the film room. You know, you got a quarterback who's signed, I don't know how much guaranteed money Tannehill still has left, but there's no more life in that. The team needs a change right there. And they just keep bleeding players. Just players keep leaving and stuff. They're saddled with a bunch of bad contracts. I just don't know how you turn that ship around. I mean, the best player they have defensively is still Cameron Wake. It was the same situation 10 years ago. Like, what is happening? How can you not? I guess Xavien Howard's better. Let's be honest. Xavien Howard. But Kiko Alonso keeps knocking out quarterbacks as they try to slide. Laremy Tunsil is a left tackle or he's a guard. Nobody can seem to decide. Albert Wilson might have been their best offensive player. They just keep drafting players who have incredible talent and just don't pan out. They're not developing their talent. There's no motivation in that organization. And I would just like to announce my candidacy for head coach of the Miami Dolphins. I think I could turn the ship around. I think I could make it happen. But that's all nonsense. Look, we got playoff weekend. This is the best weekend of football all season long, all year long. The best day is New Year's Day. All those college bowl games, great bowl games. The best weekend is the divisional round. The best afternoon, I should say. I don't know. The conference championship day is pretty damn good, but New Year's Day is just awesome. There's football from the moment you wake up beyond the moment you go to sleep, and it's all good teams. So I'm not giving that up. New Year's Day is still number one, but this is the best weekend. And there, I don't remember games being this good. I haven't looked back at the seasons to see what the matchups were. But, like last year, the Patriots versus the Titans, you're just like, come on. Is this really a divisional round game? This is nonsense. Even, what's funny, the Steelers-Jaguars was the same way last year. We're like, look, we know it's going to be Pat-Steelers in the AFC Championship game. But there's something about that Jaguars team that just gets right under the skin for the Steelers. So you never know what's going to happen. Like I said earlier, my upset pick is the Colts. I'm sticking with that because I don't think Andy Reid. I'm not saying anything bad about Andy Reid. Guy's incredible. Probably should win Coach of the Year. We'll see. I don't know why that award is always like, look, the team was bad, and then he made them good. It's like, couldn't you just be the best team in the league? That's why Bill Belichick never wins that award, because they're always good. So when they're absolutely great, it's just like, oh, he just made them a couple tweaks better. But when you look at what Andy Reid's doing with that Chiefs offense, it's insane. It's insane the amount of speed they're able to put out there and how they can scheme to get them open. They can spread the ball around all these different playmakers. He's doing an incredible job, but he won't get the credit for it because they were a playoff team very recently. Whereas you're going to see Matt Nagy probably get it because, one, he's a new name, and two, it's all about win differential. How many more wins did you get this year than last year? And a lot of that has to do with how did the coin flip in those close games? You look at games that are decided by 3 points or less, they tend to go 50-50. It tends to go both ways. Now, the Patriots have a tendency to win most of those games, but it's not like 90% of those games. It's like 60% of those games. And you'll have teams that will win. They'll go like 6-1 in a season in games that are decided by 3 points or less. And sometimes that happens the year after they went like 1-6. And then all of a sudden, a 5-11 team is 11-5 team. And you go, oh, shoot, how did this coach do it? And it's just like, sometimes it's the bounce of the ball. Sometimes they drop an interception. Sometimes the kick goes in. Sometimes your kicker doesn't pull his hamstring out of his hip joint. It all comes back to Janikowski. What can you say? All right, I'm going to wrap it up here. Stop rambling. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy the best weekend of football of the year. And I will talk to you next week, hopefully after another Patriots win. See ya.